Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Good morning, Professor.
Good to be in touch. I hope you hear me well.
Hear you loud and clear. The internet from San Salvador here is a little bit spotty, but if it works for you, I'm happy to do it this way.
Well, let's try. And if it fails us, I will excuse us from the audience, and then I'll zoom to you. Offline. I mean, not on live stream. I'll come to you as a Zoom, and we'll record that way. And that's our backup. This is a live audience, and they certainly understand we're in beta mood for this. I've been doing it since about January. It records itself, and it has advantages, but disadvantages as well. So here we go. It's 8 o'clock. I have an orchestra that gives us an introduction. And then we'll go to Bolivia, Peru, Colombia, Brazil, the usual gang. Peru, of course, because the count goes on. Here we go, Evan.
Sounds good.
Good day. This is World Cup kicks off day in Mexico. South Africa versus Mexico. It's extremely exciting. I do not understand the excitement. I was raised on baseball, not on football, soccer. So the skill set is fabulous. I see it, but I don't live it the way I do with baseball. I can see a clip from 10 seconds on a baseball play and put everything together in motion. And I'm certain that is what the rest of the world can do with this game that begins Mexico versus South Africa. There will be a number of critical performances these next days. And if you do not know football, you're an outsider. You don't understand the excitement, the enthusiasm, the risk. Can you remember who won the Super Bowl last year? I can't. Can you remember who won the World Series last year? I'm going to guess Dodgers, but I'm not certain. But with World Cup,
I have to confess, John, I can't.
I welcome Evan Ellis, Professor Evan Ellis, the U.S. Army War College. He's traveling, and he's closer to Mexico than I am right now. But in any event, the rest of the world is excited about this, and so we'll manufacture excitement as well, although we have genuine risk to report to you. This is the New World Report. I'm John Batchelor in southern New England, and I welcome Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College traveling. He is in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador, Central America, a state that has been blessed and burdened by one man named Nayib Bukele, who is the popular but controversial president of a small country that has exorbitantly defeated drug cartels, we're told, with a great deal of effort and treasure and blood. But the jails of El Salvador are controversial always, and we'll speak to that. Professor, a very good day to you. I didn't mean to presume that you did not know football and soccer. Do you, Evan?
I have followed politics and security issues far closer than football and soccer, which has always been a bit of an Achilles heel. I'm one of those people who watches the Super Bowl when it occurs, but I can tell you that my Mexican friends and colleagues are very excited about the World Cup. Mexico City has been a bit chaotic and very, very expensive to get a hotel room in any decent place. But Mexico is certainly very proud of hosting the World Cup and certainly getting ready for the first game.
Yes, let us take into account that everything that happens these next weeks is secondary to keeping your eye on a screen somewhere. This is around the world. It doesn't matter whether you're in the outback and the Australian continent and it's wintertime and it's unusually damp, or in the Sahel of Africa, worried about Ebola outbreak and DR Congo, or the jihadis operating in Uganda. It doesn't matter. You keep your eye on a little screen somewhere. I can only guess how they're going to do it in Russia, because the internet now is a plaything of the FSB. However, we're going to attend to other things besides football and soccer. That is the vote in the Americas. This is the New World Report. And, Professor, this is also the making of the John Batchelor Show. So let us discuss for our audience how we set these things up. My presumption is you're in El Salvador, and we'll begin where you are and what the atmosphere is like, what the government believes it has achieved with its defeat of the apparent defeat of cartels. The murder rate went down dramatically in 24 to 25 and continues. And then we'll go to where you've come from. You know, I'm beginning to associate you with disorder, Evan. You've come from Bolivia, which in no way is settled. I do not have an update on the siege. I don't have anybody saying that La Paz is not under siege. So we'll lay out the story there. That is an election that was successfully conducted with a new president who is seen as sympathetic to transparency and outside investors. And what you'd have to say is the virtues of a constitution. However, he is being challenged by a man who has no affection for any government whatsoever except his own, Evo Morales. Then I believe that we have Peru, which is described right now as knife's edge between Kiki Fujimori, the candidate, daughter of a previous president, but the candidate who's associated with center-right and lost the last election 4 years ago, and a man, Sanchez, I believe his name is, who's associated with the left of center and some aspect of the man who won 4 years ago, Castillo, although Castillo is now incarcerated for corruption. You'll correct me, Professor, if I summarize this inaccurately, but Peru is going back and forth in the count. The election was last Sunday. In the count, because the votes are coming in from overseas, and the diaspora was always seen as favoring Fujimori. We also have Colombia that had its first round, and the professor will analyze those results. We also have Lula da Silva versus the younger Bolsonaro, where the polls there are tilting towards Lula. And then, of course, not to leave out, good heavens, not to leave out Venezuela, where the story remains mysterious sometimes, positive other times. Professor, beg pardon, but this is the making of, so we've set our agenda. What I'm thinking is El Salvador to Bolivia to Peru to Colombia to Brazil. Does that suit you, and do you want to put anything inside there?
That sounds good to me. The one thing you've probably been following, of course, is the announcement by President Trump on Mexico that we will not renew USMCA, that we're going to go to essentially a year by year. And this is actually something we talked about on previous shows, that this would probably happen. And so now it has officially happened. So that, I think, certainly for the Mexicans, that's a pretty big news, because it affects everyone who's making investment decisions about what to do in Mexico for the coming years, as well as their politics.
Professor, I'm going to make a decision on the basis of the internet that I'm hearing right now. I believe, although this is a live stream and everybody can see us, I think it's wise for us to continue in audio because we're going to use it in the radio show. So if you can take your picture down, that will burden the internet less. And it'll just be,
sounds good.
Just be an image. Let me see what it looks like. I'm sure our colleagues watching us appreciate why we're doing this. Let me see.
Yeah, we have a tropical storm Christina coming through here in San Salvador, so that may have something to do with.
I'll take my notes as best I can. I get fussy about this, but at some point I go, I can't fuss anymore. We're dealing with the early 21st century internet, and our successors in the next century will forgive us as if we're dealing with a crank telephone, you know, one exchange per town, that sort of thing. Good heavens. They had to guess whether the internet worked or not. How do I sound to you, Evan?
You sound perfect, John.
All right. So far there's no disruption. Here we go. 5, 4, 3. Thank you, Evan. 2.
Thank you,
John. 1. I'm John Batchelor, and this is the New World Report with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. He is traveling. He is in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador in Central America. Evan is obliging us to take down the video of his internet because El Salvador has various connections. One of them is not a certain internet to me this morning through the services of StreamYard. So you will forgive us, and I will begin now as an audio only. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. This is the New World Report. Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College is traveling. He is in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador, a small state with big dreams and a controversial and successful and popular and unusual President Nayib Bukele. Ambitions for the crypto, ambitions for law enforcement, ambitions for being welcome into the Oval Office. However, we turn our attention to where Evan just came from, which is Bolivia, a very troubled state, landlocked in that it doesn't have access to the sea, but it does border Brazil. And when last we spoke, Evan was in Santa Cruz, a city not the capital, near the Brazilian border. He was there because it was not safe, according to American officials, to be in La Paz, the capital. It was under siege. Professor, I do not have a fresh report from Bolivia. What is the state of the siege? The detail from last week was that the army was going to make an appearance and seek to break the blockade. Good day to you, Evan.
Good day to you, John. Well, in Bolivia, things really continue apace. They haven't gotten better, but they have not yet deteriorated. Probably the biggest news in Bolivia from the past week was that the law that was working its way through the two houses of Congress, essentially to take away some of the restrictions on being able to declare a state of emergency and what the military could do in a state of emergency. That law has now passed, and it's been ratified by the president. The question now is, will the president use it to actually bring the military out into the streets to try to break up some of these blockades? There were incidents, for example, there was one critical point in the lowlands in Santa Cruz where I was previously, where you had the police who attempted to break up some of the blockades that were there, very important to the economy of Santa Cruz. As was feared, there were people with guns on the side of the leftists, sharpshooters, and so some four police were actually shot, ambushed. And so there's increasing essentially calls, really looking at this not as legitimate protests, although there are legitimate issues, but really as a group of really narco-funded, terrorists, coming out of the Chapar or, de facto led by Evo Morales, who was holed up there on essentially child trafficking charges for which he did not show up in court, and the question of whether Evo will push the broader set of supporters to try to use that pressure, the blockades and other things, to bring down the government either by getting elections, which Paz continues to say that the Constitution doesn't establish that a president in the middle of his term should have elections just because a small group doesn't like him. But the risk is that if things go badly with deploying the military into the streets to break up the roadblock, if either there is an escalation of bloodshed, or on the other hand, the military, for whatever reason, would refuse to act because of questions of loyalties or concerns about prosecution, that could precipitate an event that gets exactly what the Evistas want, which is the resignation. But right now, really, the situation continues to be a bit of a stalemate. But really, who is suffering are the people, especially in the capital, La Paz, which only sporadically are getting gasoline and food and even medical oxygen and other critical supplies for hospitals.
Professor, let us recover Evo Morales and his ambitions. He has been out of office for many years now, floating between various capitals that were accepting of him, a man in exile. And yet he has had ambitions not only to upset the situation in Bolivia, but other countries as well. He's attached to the radical left and also to narco-terrorism these many years. Does he still remain a powerful figure without La Paz, without a government, or is he a gangster? I'm trying to measure what his siege of La Paz represents to the rest of the Americas, where they're making choices routinely now between the narco-terrorist sympathetic governments and those opposed to narco-terrorism. What is the opinion of Evo today?
I would say, John, he's a dangerous figure more than a powerful figure. Certainly within the group of the union of coca growers there in Chapare, which is a very small part of the Department of Cochabamba, he has a lot of power. The problem is that the Chapare is the key place where coca is not only produced but turned into cocaine, and most of that cocaine flows to Europe, which means that there's a lot of money that's coming into those coca unions, which with a certain de facto leadership by Evo Morales is able to channel money into paying for buses to take protesters to other parts of the country, paying the money that the people need to survive to be out there on the streets, buying them food and things like that. In the broader regional context, number one, of course, if the Paz government falls, a pro-U.S. but centrist government, then at a time when the U.S. is trying to emphasize a group of U.S.-friendly cooperative governments in the region, that creates a grave problem. Indeed, if you look at some of the places that are impacted, a lot of the illegal mining and cocaine flows, for which Evo Morales has a key role. Some of it is connected with Bolivia. With Peru. In neighboring Peru to the west, you also have a similar group of indigenous that Evo Morales has tried to influence before. And so you have a possibility that leftist Roberto Sanchez could prevail in the Peruvian elections. As we see before, the people who represent some of those Andean highlands before, like Pedro Castillo that you mentioned, if you have the synergy between a destabilized Bolivia in which Evo Morales comes to power, and a new, left government receptive to indigenous activism, you could have a difficult situation in Peru, where you already have substantial corruption, other narco trafficking, influence of the Chinese. It goes even farther. There's inroads with the cocaine flows into the north of Argentina. You have cocaine flows into Brazil and elsewhere in the region. And more broadly, there are also long Cuban ties with Evo. They are not directly connected to the cocaleros per se, but really trying to nudge things in a destructive direction that serve their agenda. So right at the time when we are trying to bring political change in Cuba, the loss of a U.S. ally and its replacement by a Cuba-backed cocalero would be at least symbolic reverse for the U.S. agenda in the region, and would open the door as we saw previously with Evo Morales, to other actors, China, which was very active in Bolivia before, but has been frozen out for a while. Certainly Russia, certainly the Iranians have been here. Hezbollah has been here. So there's, even though Bolivia often receives little attention in Washington, strategically, Bolivia in the center of the region, there's arguably a lot at stake, not only for this country, but also its neighbors and the U.S. agenda and the Americas.
And the State Department's opinion of Bolivia at this point is that it's gravely at risk. Have they moved to recommending American citizens not travel there? Is there a warning? What is Washington's opinion of the present crisis?
Well, there has not, to the best of my awareness, been an upgrade of the alert status from the embassy, as you've seen in some other countries. But certainly the State Department and various elements in the U.S. government have strongly supported President Paz through tweets, through other messages, through other forms of support. So it's interesting to see that even though Bolivia previously received relatively little attention, you had an important tweet that came out of the State Department. I believe you had a tweet that came from Chris Landau. You even had a tweet from the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, talking about us not accepting the advance of narco-terrorists trying to overthrow democratically elected governments. And so, clearly Bolivia has gotten attention, has gotten a certain number of senior U.S. leadership visits in recent weeks. And so I think there certainly is strong support for this continuation of the democratically elected government of this pro-U.S. leader.
Right now, your characterization of La Paz, it sounds fragile. It's been this way for some weeks. Are people evacuating the city? Is there a trend to go to the countryside to wait this out?
In general, John, I didn't see a whole lot of that. In part, number one, because by definition there are blockades. Not only can you not get food and gasoline in, but there's really it's not that easy to get out either. Even the what we call metro cables that go around the land transportation system, there have been some attempt by protesters to cut those off. But my sense is that the people are pretty much staying put for now, but really trying to weather through the storm and hoping things get better. In other parts of the country, it's bad, as I understand it. In, for example, Cochabamba, in Santa Cruz, the more prosperous lowlands, there have been some concerns about the economic impact of the blockades on certain key routes. But supplies were still getting into Santa Cruz, and so I think there and in other parts in what they call the Media Luna, you have more indignation and frustration than you have people actually trying to leave. So it's varied, but I haven't seen at least broad evacuations to this point.
Professor Evan Avalos of the U.S. Army War College, he's traveling. He's in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. We march to the sound of voting, and it continues in a very tense contest in Peru. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. He is traveling. He is in El Salvador in Central America. Our eyes are on the voting underway and anticipated throughout the Americas. These are all critical votes because of trends and also because there's no transparency. We're doing some guessing here when we come to close elections. Close elections, my opinion, can stand for a healthy democracy. It can also stand for a great deal of risk. Right now in Peru, the lead is going back and forth as they count slowly because votes come in from outside the country, the diaspora. Keiko Fujimori, who has stood for the presidency before, she lost the last time in a close election, and to my memory did not contest it in any irregular way, is now leading, according to Reuters in these last hours, leading because of the count of votes coming in from the diaspora over a man named Sanchez, who's a professional man, a member of the assembly, a physician, I believe, but in any event educated. And now and again, he associates himself with Castillo, the previous president, who's been jailed for corruption and remains incarcerated because Sanchez chooses to wear a big hat. That, for some reason, has come to has come to represent the populism in Peru. Peru is extremely important to the future of the 21st century because of its natural resources, and the People's Republic of China has built a strong relationship with Peruvian business, mining, the capital, including building a major deep water port that is controlled by China. All this adds up to the vote count going both ways. Professor, if I understand correctly, there will be challenges, there will be recount, but what are you watching? What is particularly revelatory to you about as we wait?
Well, I think, first of all, John, whatever happens, there will be a sense of question and polarization and frustration and doubt over this count. It's just so close right now. You know, literally in the most recent, as we were taping this, Keiko is up by 50.002 to Sanchez at 49.998. So it's just that close. But it's worth remembering that in round one of this two-round election, a couple of weeks ago, you had a similar issue over the vote count, and so this has been a problem. But the dynamics really, a lot of the support from Keiko Fujimori has come from the greater Lima area. A lot of the support from Sanchez comes from some of the poorer surrounding barrios of Lima, what they call the Cono Norte, and some of the more marginalized areas of other urban areas, as well as in the countryside and what in Peru they call the mountains and the jungle, the Sierra and Selva. But as you alluded to, as the vote has come in, so you had an initial, support for Keiko as some of those Lima votes came in, and then some of the vote came in from some of the areas where it was more difficult to get the results. Sanchez jumped in and jumped on top. But in general, the diaspora, who tends to be more prosperous, more conservative, especially in the United States, tend to overwhelmingly support the more conservative candidate, Keiko, here. And so as that later diaspora vote has come in, Keiko's votes have run up. But it's estimated that it's going to be at least weeks. Some 400,000 votes are being contested. But as you also point out, John, whatever does happen, and it looks like Keiko Fujimori will probably take this conservative, relatively pro-U.S., but it's worth remembering that Roberto Sanchez really represents much of the same thing that Pedro Castillo previously represented, which is the people from marginalized areas feeling excluded by Peru's, the way that money works, the distribution of wealth, the system itself, the perception of corruption. But behind that frustration is the fact that you also have others who look to exploit the frustration of the marginalized in ways that could bring to power interests tied with the Cubans, interests tied with other leftist causes. And at a time where the People's Republic of China already has a substantial foothold, you mentioned the port of Chiang Kai, which continues to go forward with Costco. Some seven major mining projects are owned by China. They are the dominant mining power in the country. They control much of the internet, literally all electricity distribution in Greater Lima. So the question of justice for or a voice for the marginalized goes to broader geopolitical issues that have to do with a non-transparent advance of China in the name of a populist government. So there is a lot at stake as we see, who wins. But whoever wins, you're going to have approximately half of the country feeling threatened and betrayed.
Fujimori, she's qualified only because the backstory includes her father, who's deceased now, but was disgraced when in office. My memory is that this had to do with narco-terrorism, the Shining Path, the revolutionary group. Is that correct? Or is that what he was jailed for, his brutality?
Well, he was basically jailed for corruption allegations and also... But it was imputed for ties with various human rights violations. He had also a relatively corrupt former intelligence head, Montesinos, there were a number of problems and corruption associated with that.
Let's continue, but, Professor, let's continue about this, because the backstory will be everything if she is successful into the palace. Professor Evan Ellis, this is the New World Report, and we're talking about Peru, which is at risk right now. I'm John Batchelor. I shouldn't have asked such a big question right before the end, so we'll take it up. Is it Shining Path? Is that the country that was struggling with it?
That's correct, yes. In Spanish, they say Sendero Luminoso, which is Shining Path.
Okay. Very violent.
Yes. A Maoist organization.
Wow, man, boy, is that 20th century. Oof. 5, 4, 3. We'll start with Peru, and then we'll go to Colombia and the threats that Petro's making, or has made. And then we have Lula, and then we have Venezuela. Good heavens. The good news we have is Argentina, opening its arms to AI.
Yes, that's a weird story.
Yeah, what a weird thing to do. And then we also have the USMCA dance that the president is insisting on.
Yes.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College is here. He's traveling. He's in El Salvador, the capital, San Salvador. But we're speaking of events throughout the Americas because the vote's underway or counts still in the balance, such as Peru. And first round behind us, looking to the second round in Colombia, and certainly looking to the big presidential election in Brazil later this year. Right now, though, I asked a professor about the backstory of Keiko Fujimori, who momentarily leads and then is behind in the vote count in Peru. Her father was a president, President Fujimori, who is deceased now, but was disgraced, at least in the headlines I remember, and jailed after or during and subsequent to his presidency. So, because Fujimori, the daughter, could very well win this contest, too close to call, what is the backstory? What is she associated with? My memory, Professor, is that working into the controversy in Peru was this romantic, extremely violent guerrilla organization, terror organization called Shining Path. What was it? What did it want? And what did Fujimori do about it? And is that still a story that people tell and vote on in Peru?
Well, John, it's certainly part of the legacy. In many ways, the votes for Keiko Fujimori for many Peruvians have to do with their perception or recollection of the way in which her father, Alberto Fujimori, was seen to have basically saved the country from this brutal Maoist terrorist organization. So Sendero Luminoso, Shining Path, was born in the Andean highlands. It really was born in 1980 in Ayacucho, but they had infiltrated the teachers' union, SUTEP at the time, and others, and went on to wage a very bloody campaign. And it was very bloody on both sides, both on the military response and otherwise. But during Alberto Fujimori's period in the presidency, he had a hardline, militarily led crackdown on Sendero Luminoso. They had gotten to the point where they were even... in Miraflores. Through that military campaign, which involved a lot of questionable acts by the Peruvian armed forces, but in the end, a lot of brutality on both sides. The head, Abel Guzman, was captured. Little by little, they retook control of the countryside. There were other questions associated with Fujimori in terms of corruption and in terms of the activities of his intelligence head, Vladimir Montesinos. There were issues with respect to when he did what they called an alto golpe. He basically dissolved Congress, saying that was necessary to preserve democracy. And so for those who remember that legacy, either, you know, again, he was somebody who saved the country from the radical Cuban-inspired left, or he was somebody who was seen as, you know, corrupt and a human rights abuser. And Keiko herself, who once distanced herself a bit from that legacy in recent years, came to embrace it. The Fujimori family, which also included her brother Kenji, they again became politically iconic. Keiko traditionally had a lot of high negatives. There were certain accusations of corruption against her as well. She was actually put in jail in preventative detention, I believe, twice in the recent years, as I recall. But I think you know, she would say that that was essentially kind of an unfair lawfare campaign against her. So again, depending on which side you believe, you know, the Fujimori family are either you know, part of what saved Peru, the need for a strong hand, much like you know, you have those legacies which are remembered in Chile with the Pinochets or the military period in Brazil. So in many ways, people are, you know, not so much just voting for Keiko as a legacy of the need for a strong law and order Peru against what in today's parlance is not Sendero Luminoso. They've been almost decimated. There's maybe, you know, 200 or 300 hiding out in the Apurimac, Eni, and Mantaro River valleys. But really what today's issues are about is the massive corruption and comes from narco violence, that comes from illegal mining activities, that comes from the extortion and gang activities in the major cities that has accompanied all of that illicit money, and in a sense that you know, something needs to be done because the country is going deeper and deeper into a spiral of corruption and violence. And so the question of, do you need a, you know, strong arm to push back against both the left and this corruption, or do you go with somebody who is, you know, speaking in the name of the long neglected marginalized people of the Andean highland in the jungle region. So it's really about two legacies, two Perus. And again, at 50.002 for Keiko right now versus 49.998 for Sanchez, the country will be divided whoever wins, but it also has implications of where Peru goes geopolitically with the United States, China, and others.
And Sanchez is associated with Castillo, and he was associated with an outside advisor who I believe was trained in Cuba or was Cuban. Is that still pertinent to Sanchez as it was to Castillo?
Correct. Depending on who you talk to, who you believe, you know, Sanchez's ties are questionable, but he is a, you know, strong, you know, left-oriented, I believe a psychologist. So again, highly educated. He has been a congressperson representing far left views for a long time. The person that he is also tied with was the same person who was seen as the puppet master behind the previous leftist president, Pedro Castillo, is a Cuban trained doctor by the name of Vladimir Soron, among others. And so the real concern is there's this kind of group of folks with the Cubans being the puppet masters. And so, you know, the question really is this highly educated Roberto Sanchez really a more capable, more educated version of Pedro Castillo, who in a much more brutish way, you know, two presidencies ago, also took the country to the brink in terms of corruption and moving away from, you know, the West and giving certain license to, you know, corrupt Chinese companies to operate in the construction and various other sectors.
Backstory is the campaign in many of these instances that the professor has guided me to. We're going to say that the backstory in Peru is critical for the vote, and go to Colombia, where the backstory is critical to the vote. The man Gustavo Petro cannot succeed himself. That is by constitutional mandate in Colombia. However, he has a candidate, Cepeda, who is associated with Gustavo Petro and the backstory of terrorism. Gustavo Petro was a terrorist associated with an extremely violent group, and he has endorsed Cepeda. All right, an outgoing president has that permission. They are opposing a group that is is surrounded by, associated with a previous president, Uribe. What is new here is we've had a first round. And in the first round, a new voice emerged from the Uribe camp, taking a lead in the polling so far, The first round included many candidates. Now there'll be two in the second round. I believe the vote is in the middle of June, soon enough. Here's what's new. After the vote, after the first round vote, in which Cepeda is to campaign against this newcomer, Gustavo Petro stepped in and made threats about violence. Puzzling. And I've waited. I don't want to characterize it more than that. I've waited for the president, for the president's situation to straighten out, but it didn't since then. So I need your help, Evan. Why did Petro do such a, what you'd have to say was not wise, a maneuver in favor of his candidate to make threats?
Well, certainly Petro gets himself into trouble saying a lot of things, including comments on U.S. policy, which has gotten Colombia sanctioned, and some very negative interactions and relations with the United States and President Trump, among others. And so Petro is a bit of an imprudent talker. And indeed, it's interesting that one of the more recent moves, and it remains to be seen whether this will go forward or not, the head of a legislative commission in the Colombian Congress, Gloria Azurbaleta, who is actually the wife of a previous Pedralay, Roy Barreras, came out with a decision saying that Petro should be suspended because from his presidential duties, because under Colombian law, a president is not allowed to support an ongoing candidate, even one of his own movement, in this case, Pacto Histórico. Now, some people have cynically said that this actually may be a move by the left to allow Petro to do more campaigning, because if you suspend Petro from the presidency, then he can say whatever he wants. It also means that Francine Marquez, the even more radical left Afro-Colombian vice president, could become president in these last days, which could make things even crazier. But aside from what Petro says, and if he is or is not suspended, people say that probably constitutionally that couldn't happen, and you'd need a vote of the entire commission, even if it could. But however that plays out, what you also allude to, John, is that you have with these two candidates, on the one hand, with Ivan Cepeda, who doesn't have the guerrilla background that Petro had with M19, but he is very far to the left and has a strong record of that as senator. But there's a sense that Colombia really has unraveled. It's gone in a very negative direction with Petro not going after cocoa production, his failed total peace plan, really opening up the country to a proliferation of the number and strength of armed groups, enormous influx of corruption in the country, very bad relations with the United States, political paralysis. And so in many cases, it's a tale of two Colombias. One Colombia that supports the left, now represented by Ivan Cepeda, young people, Generation Zers, and others, who listen to the rhetoric, who believe that there's injustice, what they call the Stratus 6 people, the families of Colombia who have long kind of informally run everything, that this situation needs to be corrected. Others who are represented by this very strongly hard right lawyer, Alvarado de la Espria, who again unexpectedly not only came out first among the right candidates, but actually came out on top, really representing the frustration that many Colombians are feeling. But that takes Colombia in a very different direction. De La Espria is very hard talking. He's talked about crushing and wiping out the criminals in Colombia like cockroaches and rats, that he would build mega prisons like Bukele here in El Salvador, that he would end the armed conflict within 90 days with a strong hand, President Trump talked about doing so, ending the war in the Ukraine. So in many ways, for those Colombians who feel that the left has gotten out of control and this soft hand has gotten out of control and has really taken Colombia down a very difficult path, Cepeda, in many ways, although he talks in a very hardcore, kind of brutish way that for many Colombians I've talked to can be somewhat offensive and divisive, but there's a sense that he represents that frustration, that there's a need for a hard hand to get Colombia back under control and back to the nation of innovation and creativity and sophistication that really represents the real Colombia in Bogota and Medellin and elsewhere for many of the Colombians that I work with.
The election is soon enough. It will be close. Well, we marched to votes, but so many close elections, you have allegations that go on for years. We're going to turn to the big story in Brazil, but the professor reminds me he's in El Salvador, so we'll come back and talk about the issues there that are pending. Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College, Strategic Studies Institute. This is the New World Report. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. He is in El Salvador. We're speaking of Brazil momentarily because the polls are indicating a tilt back towards Lula da Silva. Why? According to Reuters, this has to do with Flavio Bolsonaro, the son of the previous president, who remains under house arrest and is not healthy. The son is associated with a banking scandal. And that, according to Reuters, is why the polls are now showing Lula da Silva in the lead. Professor, does this add up? Because Lula da Silva is a man who was jailed for corruption, never resolved that conflict. He is out of jail and ran for president, not because the verdict was reversed, but because of a technicality about prosecution. So holding Flavio Bolsonaro responsible for association with a corrupt banker seems facile. Is it, or is it a profound blow to his campaign?
Things seem to be going downhill quickly for Flavio Bolsonaro with implications for Brazil, John, which, of course, as you know, is half of the geography, half of the population, half of the economy of all of South America, with an outsized influence not only here but globally. In many ways, you can talk about two Brazils in an increasingly polarized context, just like you can talk about two Colombias or two Perus, as we've alluded to before. And so, in many ways, this is the nostalgia of the past, because many of Flavio Bolsonaro's supporters really aligned with his father, Jair Bolsonaro, who was jailed and politically inhabilitated by the judge Alexandre de Moraes in a system which many people feel has been weaponized against him. You're talking about Brazilians who feel that the left under Lula really had weaponized their way of being the agriculturalists, the more conservative Brazilians. And on the other hand, those of Lula believing that those of Jair Bolsonaro represented an anti-democratic tendency, accusing Jair Bolsonaro during his time of trying to perpetuate himself in power in a coup with the military, although the outcome of that judicial proceeding is questionable. But in that kind of two Brazils in which in the polls, Flavio Bolsonaro and Lula representing in many ways memories of past Lula regimes, which were probably a lot better than the current one has been. In the middle of this came this scandal, this important bank, Banco Master, whose head, Daniel Volcaro, had been associated with all kinds of corruption, frankly, corruption with leaders on the left touching Lula as much as leaders on the right. But what apparently seemed to sink Flavio Bolsonaro was that he was on tape as having actually approached Volcaro, the person at the center of the scandal, to try to get Banco Master to fund a $24 million film, basically on the positive aspects of his father. And so, that kind of very politicized piece of that seems to have caused the accusations of ties of corruption towards the right with Flavio to take a greater weight than the probably equal ties of corruption with the same Daniel Volcaro, with Lula and people on the left. And so because this seems to be sticking, unfortunately, it's brought Flavio down a couple of points in the polls. The polls now show 44% for Lula, 38% for Flavio if the election were held today. We're still a ways off. The election's going to be on in October. But again, what happens in that, as the polls go up and down, is going to be very important to the future of Brazil and the region.
You are in San Salvador. So here in the closing couple of minutes, is the Bukele controversy past bias? Was that a momentary series of headlines? Does he remain popular, and is San Salvador prospering?
Well, there are certainly issues, and I think deep and real questions. Bukele has changed the Constitution. He's going to go forward with another re-election. There are questions about the approximately 10% of the people that are in Salvadorian jails right now who, by estimates, are there by accident because of the way that prosecutions are carried out. There are issues with the defunding of NGOs. There's a leftist organization, a paper right now called El Faro, that is really been the direct product of a lot of different legal attacks. But all of those issues aside, and they are substantial issues, John, I have to say that when you say, well, with all of this, why is Bukele backed by 93%, literally 93% of the Salvadoran people? And being here, the transformation of the country, I have to say, John, is amazing. It's stunning. The center of the city, what they call the old historic district, that just a couple of years ago, I couldn't even go to it at night because there's just so much insecurity and gangs and things like that. There's now a beautiful Chinese-built library. There are other buildings. There are posh, ritzy hotels. The streets are clean and safe and well-lit. There is a return of urban life. There's something like 80 different new construction buildings. There's a beautiful skyscraper with the name Google, that Google, on top of it. And so across the country, it's not just about the Chinese. There's a sense that the bringing of security back in streets, It has revitalized the country. It's attracted investment. Bukele has been very good in rebranding the country and reconnecting. And so at the end of the day, maybe sadly or cynically, Salvadorians are willing to accept a certain loss of
wonderful
democracy.
Wonderful news. A wonderful finish to the story. Professor Evan Ellis in San Salvador, a new day. I'm John Batchelor. I forgot the time momentarily, and we went a little over, but I can handle it. What a surprise, Evan. What a surprise.
It is, I don't get stunned easily, but the transformation here is if you could have seen just how bad things were here just a couple of years ago, it is amazing how things have changed. I mean, in the streets, the security, the buildings, the lights, the sense of things going forward, it is, I mean, not even in Colombia was there this transformation. So you say, why is Bukele that popular? And he's changed the country so much, in investment and other things. And then he's sold the story in social media, and it's really kind of disturbing that most Salvadorians are willing to look the other way with 10% of the people accidentally in jail, and a certain loss of democracy because the country's functioning. And that's very worrisome. But when you're here, you get a feeling of why people are willing to make that cynical trade-off.
Well, certainly I can think of a few cities in the U.S. who would make that trade-off.
The word people are using is Singapore. Salvador is becoming the Singapore of Central America.
Well, good for Bukele. He's had some bad headlines, and maybe he read them and changed course. If you have an imperfect jurisprudence, you're going to make mistakes at the scale he's made them.
As an administrator and as a social media person, he's impressive. I mean, he does the little things to coordinate public-private sector, not only security but also investment in other things. He plays the Trump game well, and he sells it well, including to the young people, of which I think the average age in El Salvador is 19 years of age. And so he actually does do a lot of things really well. It's just that, it's all of those concerns about, well, maybe there's corruption, maybe certain people are favored, maybe 10% of the people in Sicot in the jails are, shouldn't actually be there. Maybe anybody that opposes him is, weaponized and they go after him in the press. And so there's this kind of like disturbing undercurrent, but to be fair, you have to say that, however anti-democratic he actually is a remarkably good administrator and salesperson.
I take it in.
It's Lee Kuan Yew.
Oh, Lord. Trump says the U.S. will attack Iran again tonight and seize the crucial oil hub, Karg Island, in the near, not too distant future. The Financial Times jokes, ceasefire. Before the market opens. Again, the pattern. We didn't get to USMCA. We will do it next week. Are you still overseas next week, Evan?
So I will. I will briefly be back in back at home. So next Thursday. Next Thursday works
at 7.
Yes, if that works for you, that works for me.
Of course it does. And thank you for doing this. This was a live broadcast. It worked out. I have some corrections to make, but there was nothing profound except for I caused a break at about 2:36 of the second half. But it's something I can handle.
Are we still live? Is this still part of the stream, or are we now past?
Yes, we're live until I bring the Roman Orchestra back. the difficulty was San Salvador, not the StreamYard. It worked perfectly. I do this show 8 to 9 every morning, 5 days a week, and I use it to talk and to speculate, and also I can record segments for the radio show later in the first hour, which is what I just did.
And we didn't even mention Tropical Storm Christine, because, I mean, the rain down here is coming out in just buckets. And at the coast, you've had like major damage. We're like right at the heart of the storm.
And it held up with no breaks.
Yes.
Once in a while. Indeed. A yaw. So thank you, Evan. Travel safe. We will speak in a week's time. And let me bring the Roman Orchestra on so you can see the close. Thanks, everybody, for staying with us in the storm and in the vicissitudes of news. Here comes the Romans. Take it away, boys and girls.
Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away. all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.